that were working on it, why that very appealing approach to a vehicle of that sort.
Yeah. Was and, the small car studio a part of the downsizing?
Well, we used to, years ago, the car lines were kind of Ford, Mercury, Lincoln, that kind of thing. And during that cutback in 74 and reorganization, everything, well, then rather than going by car line, it was more a size or platform. So that's how it ended up being called small car. And they had mid-size and large car and all that. But that was this kind of the major effort toward efficiency that we've since continued. But
the Fairmont was a...
Fairmont, very very handsome and came off well, sold extremely well right away. And, again, this was when Bob Alexander, chief engineer, had come back from Europe. And all of these guys were coming back with, the European experience and the intensity of ownership of vehicles over there, driving, and, the importance of good handling and all this. So they tried immediately to put some of that into effect. And to a large extent, successful. It had to meet a cost target that was pretty severe on the Fairmont. But it very good base kind of vehicle when you consider the vehicles we've been able to bring off of those basic pieces, even though I'm sure none of them are common exactly, but the basic platform and width of the platform and the wheel suspension geometry and all that are basically the same the cars that we're even building today.
And economically, it carried you through a rough
period. We got through it, and that car sold well just when we absolutely needed it in the worst way, and we were able to build a Granada Monarch off of it and do some other good pieces later on.
So that was pretty much your baby.
No, I was involved with the Mustang, and I took over the Fairmont Zephyr for a period of time, and then Granada Monarch. But no, I wasn't. I think Ray Everts, actually, who is the Sierra designer, I think he actually did the Fairmont Zephyr before he went over to Europe. I think that's kind of the way it went. I've forgotten that, but
you agreed with his design.
Well, the Fairmont Zephyr, yeah, it was a very. And I think Sperlich was involved in that. It was kind of a, I think he was, it was one of these logical, do it sequentially, thoughtful kind of things. And because of the cost constraints, they weren't able to, marketing or no one else could really mess it up too much by saying, make it longer or wider. I mean, basically it had to be a very concise kind of vehicle. And with this European influence from the people coming back from Europe, the engineering community, they did make a more suitable handling vehicle and a little tighter and appropriate to the time where you wanted something efficient and good economy. And they got the weight out. I mean, it was quite a lightweight vehicle initially. Made a good stepping stone for a lot of cars because we built the Mustang off of that same platform. And so it was a very pivotal vehicle for us in a lot of ways. And the Mustang, I think you'd say, the Fairmont Zephyr and the Mustang, probably both, but kind of a turning point in the approach that Ford Design was taking to their vehicles and kind of stepping away a little bit from the styling approach that might have been in place during the early 60s and where we were still doing an awful lot of things with no real worry about weight and width and concise or precision look to things. It was more just get a dramatic look and making sure that it looked expensive no matter what it is. I mean, that was always
the Mustang pace car was a successful
vehicle. Yeah, we sold well. Made an interesting time, had a chance to go down to the track. I think at least on Carburation Day I got to go down, and it was a fun time. Get a little bit of involvement and that sort of thing. And a very handsome vehicle with the spoilers and all the graphics. And then we did the Cobra, of course. So we used that same front spoiler and hood scoops. I personally was never that happy with, but that was one of those few things that we did get a little help on where we had to have a certain appearance. They always reminded me of something we did back on the 69 or 70 Mustang, which never quite fit into my mind. But the Cobra, where we reversed it, and we actually took the wedge and amplified it, even though it was a little larger than we wanted, but we had to have a certain amount of clearance to get the turbo engine under there, and the air cleaner for the turbo, and it very successful. But the other one that was sitting with the little fake scoop pointed forward, I was never very, personally never pleased with that one. But other than that, that was a good car, and the wheels, when Nehemiah did the, Nehemiah Amaker did the little three scalloped forged aluminum wheel. Very simple. I mean, just beautiful, clean, simple kind of thing. I see Saab has it on their car now. I mean, you can go through the aftermarket magazines and find that three-element design a lot of places now. So, and as far as I know, he was the first one to draw one quite like that anyway. We did quite a few innovative things. Got our mirrors sort of integrated into the A-pillar corner there, and as I said earlier about the bumper soft covers, even though in the Mustang II we had done a little of that, they were still more of a normal bumper that happened to be body color. And the Mustang, we were able to integrate it a little nicer into the total form of the vehicle. So that kind of set the stage for the kinds of things that we did later on, where we got into the current vehicles we've introduced, 83, 84.
Was the Granada Monarch program sort of a holding pattern for you?
Well, it was, in terms of my design life, I'd say so. It was one of those things where you need to do a front and a rear, and, you know, basically it was a Fairmont Zephyr kind of car, and you just found ways to carry through a little bit from the past Granada Monarchs, which had sold very well, but the platform, of course, had been become too old and heavy, and we had a new, much more modern platform in the Fairmont, so we built off of that. But again, it's a kind of car you design for, you know, the kind of middle America. They want a sedan, they want something that carries people. It's got to be a medium price, and it has to have a certain image that reminds them of at least expensive looking vehicles. And that's kind of the way we still do, I think, with our LTD Marquee today.
Right.
You know, it fits into that kind of category.
It sold very well.
Oh, yes. You know, very broad appeal to that kind of car. You know, it's
gave you a good platform for the next period that you are about to...
Yes, really, that's true. You know, the efforts. You know, Bob Alexander, I can remember him saying, because up until then, quite honestly, the general word was always, you can't do a unit construction luxury car. Can't be done. It'll always shake, and it'll never be good enough. We've been through that in the 50s or whenever they did it, and it became too heavy, and
well,
with the old link.
Well,
of course, in the early jobs back in the 50s, when they were unit construction, I mean, we had 124, I don't know how long wheelbase they were, 130, I mean, really huge. And then you're talking tremendous forces of torsional rigidity and four-door convertibles, unit construction. I mean, they had some pretty exotic stuff, and they had to use boilerplate to make them strong and all that. So I think that was kind of the mindset, because people just couldn't think that a unit construction vehicle would ever be a luxury car, and they'd look at or they'd ride in a Mercedes and say, no way, you know, that isn't acceptable, it isn't good enough. But I can remember Alexander, I don't know if I actually heard it or just heard it attributed to him, saying that, yeah, we can do it. We can do that, and we will do it. And, you know, Bob Alexander, he was a chief engineer during some of this period of time when the Fairmont was done. And very, always liked the man because he would turn to Jack Telnak and say, well, what do you recommend, you know, Mr. Designer? And maybe to the planners, because he really had charge of engineering and planning. And then he would turn to the planners and, you know, maybe ask for their recommendation rather than just choosing whatever he felt was the right answer. Maybe he ended up doing it anyway, but his approach was always much more appropriate, I thought, to bring, you know, the best car on the road. Any very positive kind of guy.
This is a very rather innovative approach for an engineer. Design.
Well, it was in the Ford culture. Yeah. Usually, you know, it's whoever can shout loudest or is the tallest or whatever the. You know, but
the most
backing by the top people. But he was always seemed to be pretty good at that, and would take recommendations from Jack. And of course, they'd work together in Europe, and there's a certain amount of respect, I think. But I was always impressed that he actually followed through. I mean, the cars did have some of these things, and they, in spite of all the can't doers, why they were able to get a unit construction vehicle that handled well and rode well and was quiet and, you know, all, and at lightweight. It still wasn't heavy. So then when this period of time, as I was starting to say, I moved into luxury studio in 79, and this was, we had already, I think, about the time we were starting, people were still wanted to do a Versailles replacement. We had lost the car because, you know, it just didn't sell. We weren't able to bring out an alternative on the Granada Monarch base because of money constraints. But the desire, Gene still wanted to do a car. I mean, obviously, felt there was a big profit area there that we were missing. And so that summer, directive or whatever, but he wanted us to work on this proposal, and there really wasn't a program at that point. So he was, at that period of time, very much into nostalgic vehicles and Clunets and this sort of thing. And Clunet is a car that a fellow built in California for a period of time, and it's a Ford frame, like a Mark V or something, a big frame with a V8 and a fiberglass body. And a lot of handwork and a very high-quality vehicle, in fact. But I think it had a little MG midget midsection and windshield and doors, but everything else grafted on. And I mean, and it's sort of a cartoon of an old Mercedes 500K or a, you know, Rolls Royce, or, you know, it's none of those things, but kind of in that vein. You know, big exposed exhaust running back on each side, even though they weren't really hooked up exactly. But, you know, it was all. It was bringing back this nostalgia thing. And he had he bought a two-seater. Well, later on, he bought a four-seater as well, but the first one was a two-seater. It was a pretty dramatic car. You'd have to, even though it wasn't my kind of car, it was, certainly you would be noticed, and that's why he wanted it. It was just a toy and fun to have and all that. But he had this kind of vision that there was opportunity for the company to do a car either like that, specifically actually do a two-seater and do a special custom thing, and because of tremendous profit. I mean, realistically, you could sell it for 30 or 40, I don't know, whatever the number, and the pieces weren't that expensive. But he could never really sell that program within the company, because it just, no one would believe that it would actually work out with the overhead of a big corporation and all. So,
for the transcription, how do you spell
Clunet? C-L, I'd have to write it out. I'm not sure if I can spell it. Alain Clunet, he and Mark Sternberger work, I think, with Cars and Concepts now, design consultants.
Well, that's
something like that. C-L-E-N-E-T.
Great, okay.
It's a French, Frenchman.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Appropriate to Gene. He enjoyed that sort of thing.
Gene had a cosmopolitan outfit.
Oh, yes. Yeah, anything French was good. Excuse me. But, he had this kind of view that there's opportunity there. And so that summer was a pretty wild time for me, because I'd come out of what, you know, by comparison, were pretty mundane cars to be working on.
Right.
And here we are, we're starting this new Versailles replacement program, and we have pictures of all the nostalgia cars. I mean, all the old young James Young-bodied Rolls-Royces, you know, these beautiful razor-edged flowing C-pillars, and the Rolls-Royce fronts, of course, very erect and all, and noble front ends, I think Gene used to call them. And so, you know, we're going through all this as a build-up to this sedan that we were going to end up doing a model of. And at the same time, he wanted to do a two-passenger, and he'd come in and talk for hours, really, but anyway, for a long period of time, drinking coffee and talking to you about how, you know, and go through all the figures and had it all figured out how you can make money on these vehicles, and kind of thinking it out as he went, I guess, practicing on us or whatever. But anyway, interesting, you know, from a standpoint of he's an interesting guy to be around, and also he wanted to do a vehicle. So we ended up getting a Mark V, and we're going to do a two-passenger. This is a kind of a thing we could do. And so I've kind of forgotten how I ended up doing it, but I think I ended up just looking at a car and saying, well, how much could I move the rear seat or the front seat into the rear compartment? And we came up with a number, I think 13 inches. If I took the front seat, moved it where the rear one is, take the rear out. So now I have a two-passenger, and I move the cowl and the windshield and everything back, which you can do on a frame car somewhat easily. I had it moved back, We had American Sunroof do it, and
were they
American Sunroof, Heinz Prechter?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, and Southgate.
Southgate. Yeah.
And so it was a kind of a funny program in a way, and yet you know, when you're doing it for the man, when you're doing it for Mr. Bourdonnais, why, you take due concern to getting it right and all. But it was quite an effort, and we had to. Now we have 13 inches additional space between the windshield, or the door cut, and the front wheel. And rather than put in a spare tire or do anything like that, why, we put in big exhaust pipes. And these things, well, now how on earth do you do something like that these days? I mean, they aren't real, number one. We, let's see, did we end up running exhaust through some of those? Seemed like we did. I guess a part down underneath the door or something we piped in and ran it back or something. But no, I guess we didn't. No, we didn't want to burn anybody. That was it. Okay, so it was all fake, all the front part. The rears we did hook up. But it was, we took this flexible tubing. I guess it goes on a big tractor trailer, you know, where they have a flexible coupling in their exhaust. It was 3 inches in diameter or something. And we had to model the all the connectors and all these things, and then the manifold part down at the bottom. So you had these four pipes coming out out of a little panel on the side of the fender now that has kind of a wire screen like the old cords or whatever had. And of course he would come in and help get all the details just right, because he had a, you know, he had certain things that he remembered from these cars or whatever. I mean, he knew what he wanted. Yes. And so it wasn't something you just left alone to kind of do whatever you wanted. You were worked on fairly constantly, and he was very much involved. And so we finally got it the way we wanted it, and we cast them and had them chrome plated and all this. And we ended up with a two passenger Mark V with this monster long front end, long hood, and like you're sitting in the rear seat essentially. I mean, that's what it amounted to. And these pipes running down the side of the car, and under the door, big massive chrome pipe running under there, and then kind of ducked in front of the rear wheel, and then that's where we hooked up the real pipes, and then it came out the back, two big chrome exhausts. And, you know, it was all black, and, I mean, fairly tasty, I guess, by if you, you know, once you get by the fact that it's just a big put-on in a way. But in the element of a nostalgia kind of vehicle that the Cornet, and there's any number of, that's just the one that he happened to be interested in, because it was probably the best of that type of vehicle. But there are a lot of other cars that were doing, you know, people are doing that kind of car. I think Zimmer still doing that kind of car in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Zimmer Coach or whatever they call it. But just outrageous. I mean, from my view as a designer, I think they're just atrocious. But whatever it takes, you know, whatever you need. So anyway, that was sort of this summer, that was my major involvement, getting all that done as a side issue to getting the 80 Mark launched out at Wixom.
Before you did that,
yeah.
What happened to the Cornet type vehicle?
Well, that vehicle, of course, when Gene ended it, and when he retired, he had always indicated he wanted the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
But quite honestly, there's no way that any officer of the company can ever have a prototype of that sort, because there are things that have been cut and moved and all that, and if it ever got out of anyone's hands and was sold to anyone, well, I don't know what you'd be liable for, but our legal people would never let that happen. So as far as I know, it was crushed. The last I saw of it, it was being driven out of the garage with little skinny wheels on it, and of course we had big wire monster, I don't know what they were, but we actually had knockoffs on it for a while, and, you know, the real spoke wheels, and It was a fairly complete effort on our part, but it didn't last. As far as I know, it was sent to the crusher, which is a bit of it's kind of sad. I mean, it'd be kind of nice to have it over here in the museum, or at least tucked away for 20 years from now, when you could put it out as a example of the nostalgia, looking back era that we went through.
This seems to me to be sort of a bit of an anachronistic event in Ford Stein history. Here's the longtime VP of styling toward the end of his career, wanting to sort of cap his achievements with this, what turned out to be a rather odd vehicle.
Well, there were several of us that went through that analysis. You know, taking nothing away from the man, I always enjoyed working with him, quite honestly, as a person. But it was a very strange thing to be doing at that time, because to most of us, even in luxury cars, okay, by Well, by the fall of this period, we had already started our Versailles, and we were into this, like I was talking about, the James Young approach. Well, there are a lot of coach builders that use this very razor-edged C-pillar, and then a flowing line that came down over the deck with a little trunk added on. And it was just a look from the 30s. I mean, they were all, it wasn't anything that unique to one coach builder, I guess. But
would you call it Bordenave swan song, in a sense?
Well, yes, I guess you'd have to say that. I mean, several things came about, you know, change in upper management, and Peterson came back from Europe, and Poling and Caldwell. I mean, there were a lot of things going on. And suddenly they, again, here's another group of guys just from Europe and their experience. There's no way, I think anybody can go and live in Europe for any period of time and not view an automobile in a different way than they do here. They're used differently.
Right.
And it may be wrong that we try to even adapt to that approach, but there's just no way you can come back from that experience and not look at what's being done as kind of strange and try to redirect it that way. So, yeah, Gene went through a period of time where he was absolutely, at least in the studio, I mean, that was the only contact I had with him, but he was convinced that there was just terrific opportunity for the company, the Ford Motor Company, to get into some kind of a special little entrepreneur approach and go out and build some of these classic marks, you know, whatever it was. You know, we even did two cars. We did a four-door and a two-door off the European Granada. And we put a front end on it that is very similar to a Mark, you know, it was that kind of a thing, a little softer, a little different. And did them all up in black, and I mean, they were just beautifully finished. I think Sunroof did. We did the two-door again. Now, rather than extending the front end, we just shortened it. So now it's a two-door, but it's a two-passenger. And we took, you know, a two-door Granada and did that. And then the four-door was just a nice four-door with this kind of nose on the front end, big chrome grill and all that. And those cars were sent to Europe. I've never quite figured out. I mean, Gene had something in mind. I don't know if it was just to... I really don't know what he wanted to say to Bonson over there, but anyway, he sent him over there as, well, why don't you guys look into this or something? We never heard a word. Never heard... The cars were shipped away. Never heard another thing of it. It just dropped off the face of the earth. But to us, you know, they were just... It was just terrible to do that kind of thing to a European Granada, which is already a pretty decent car. And if you want to add a little chrome or do some little Ghia version, well, that's one thing, but to put kind of a old nostalgic grill face on the thing, it just seemed totally incongruous. But yeah, and maybe that was it. Maybe he had, you know, maybe he was bored with whatever. I mean, he got excited about the Cone thing, and that was his interest that summer.
In any event, an era is coming to a close, and you're embarking on a really exciting period.
Yeah, because as we were starting, and we did the Continental then, and Gene was really still very much involved in that. And so that was really his final car, I think, at least certainly that I worked on with him.
82.
Yeah. And we did that, you know, the summer and fall of 79 and kind of finished it up, and that was it.
Very successful.
And we, you know, we were very happy. We got excited about it, quite honestly. We were trying to do, okay, if you want a nostalgia car, let's do it in a modern way. And we, you know, we tried our best to make that the 82 that kind of a clean, modern look. I was always very happy with the rear end. I think the taillights are very elegant. And given the fact that it's Continental, it has a tire form, okay, you know, it's what it is. I think it's an elegant kind of car. C-pillar. I guess you could say it's reminiscent of what GM did, but I don't know. You know, like I was saying, the whole idiom came from a period in time in the 30s when all of the coach builders were doing that kind of a look. So I don't know. That, you know, whether we copied them or something, to me it wasn't that way. We did it, and by the time we had the car all modeled, then we saw pictures of what they were doing, and yeah, they are doing a nostalgia Seville. And although they did it, I always felt that they were a little more abrupt. The rear end was very nice, really, on the Seville, once you accept that kind of look. But the front end has nothing to do with that rear end.
No.
Absolutely nothing.
It is a hybrid.
And I always felt a little broken. In fact, I think our version this year of the Continental, where we revised the front end, actually is the best workout. Because when we did the 82, we wanted to pull it down a little bit, and Gene really wanted that front end up. He was really... Well, the 80 Mark and Lincoln, the town car that's still on the road, those were his cars.
Yeah.
Very much the Rolls-Royce. Make that line from the cowl to the grill level. Mm-hmm. Don't give me a crown. I want it level. You know, none of this. Don't rake it. Don't do anything.
Yeah.
And very, you know, very pure about that. But we, most of us, wanted to pull the thing down. I mean, we're into looking at how we're going to improve fuel economy and aerodynamics, how we can influence our luxury cars. And so, you know, all those things are working around our design environment, and so those are the kind of things we wanted to do. We weren't able to pull the front end down as much as we'd liked on 82, but in 84, when we did a rework, we tidied it up a little bit. I think it's the best the car has ever looked. Look, and it, with a new air suspension, well, it sits a little lower, and just the whole car comes together a little nicer. So, anyway, by this fall of 79, now we have Peterson coming back over, and he at that Don Peterson. Yeah. So he wasn't the president yet, but he soon was to be made that. And Jack, I can remember bringing him through. Well, let me back up. After we had done the Continental, and that was pretty well set. John Aiken, I think he was a director at that point. But anyway, John and I have worked together quite a number of times over the years, and we were always kicking around, well, what else would we do with a luxury car? I mean, we'd been through all the nostalgia and all this, but what would we do? And so our point, let's do an aero luxury car. I mean, that's kind of obvious, I guess. If you've done everything else, well, you go the other direction. But
aerodynamic concept has not sprung full-blown from someone's brow. This has sort of been kicking around for years.
Oh, yeah, and it's come and gone. I mean, yeah, you can go back to several different periods when it was important and then went away. And so, you know, from our point of view, well, okay, it's real. We do a lot of wind tunnel testing. We know it. You know, rather than just going in and trying to finesse, what would we do if we started out with the idea of a total shape that would really be effective, and then let's try to make a luxury car out of it. Let's see what happened. So we did quite a lot of sketches and just kind of on our own. Telnak, of course, knew what we were doing, and I guess Gene did to some extent, but Gene was in the hospital for a few months during this period of time also, so he was out of the studio and... you know, we did these sketches, and we did 3/8 models, head models, and we ran them in the wind tunnel back at University of Maryland. And anyway, we had progressed to the point where we had a full-size clay sitting on a bridge here in the studio. And Jack, of course, was pretty keen on what we were doing, but we hadn't sold him totally one way or the other either, Jack Telnak.
Right.
And so anyway, the clay was there, and he was showing Don Peterson around one day when Don was back here on a... So this was a few months before he returned. He was still in Europe at that time, and he expressed either he liked it or, I don't know, any positive remarks.
Yeah.
Well, somehow Jack was able to relay that to Gene, and I don't know if Mr. Bornier was back then from hospital or whatever, but okay, go ahead and cast it, because usually you don't cast a model unless, you know, the top guy says you can go ahead and cast it, because it invests quite a lot of money and time. So, okay, we get a mold made, and we make this beautiful fiberglass model, and it's all painted candy apple red, kind of a deep burgundy, and very nicely finished. And, of course, it has a Mark grill and a Continental on the rear, the lettering, and also the tire form. Excuse me. But a very clean look, and I guess example, the Concept 90 really ended up as a show car, but basically that was the look of the car. There were some modifications made, but basically that it. So, okay, we did the luxury car, and that kind of, okay, now we get into other programs, and we had to follow through on the Continental for feasibility, and so there's a lot of time spent on that. So now in the summer of 80, the Thunderbird program had been going on in another studio, in midsize, because I really had luxury studio. And so they're over there, normal kind of program. I think they had about 3 clay models, a Thunderbird, a couple of Thunderbirds, and a Cougar. And they've been going through a lot of design research clinics and all this. And they'd tried nearly everything, vertical backlights and fastbacks and, you know, every conceivable thing that you would normally go through in a program. But nothing had really come up, weren't any 10s yet on a rating scale. And they went into this one research clinic right here in the Design Center in June in 1980, and they had a group in, and I think this was on a Sunday afternoon. They'd already been in, and they filled out their questionnaires, and so now they have the group come back, and the moderator talks to them. And well, why didn't you like this? And what do you want to do? You know, this and that. Try to bring out a little more information from them. And so they went through that with the models that were there. And then he said, well, I don't know, whatever. I wasn't in the meeting, so I don't know what went on exactly. But they basically, well, what would you think of a car like this? And so then they had this model sitting back behind the curtains, and they opened the curtains, and here's this red fiberglass model. Well, okay, I mean, that's almost stacking the deck, because here you are, a beautiful, shiny model, and you've got these silver clay models out on the floor. But it was quite a different approach, because it had plan view, the corners tucked in, it was a tight kind of a shape over the wheels, and, you know, of course, rave reviews, everybody loved it, you know. Well, I was on vacation, and Jim Arnold was the exec, and he called me and said, by the way, they bought our luxury, 8X luxury car, I guess what we call it. They bought it as a Thunderbird. It still had the tire on the rear. We had put in an egg crate grill. Just, okay, if you want to make it a Thunderbird, well, you know, we'll do that much. But that was a quickie kind of a thing last minute. And said, that's it. So now you're going to have to think of something else for the Mark, because you can't use that one. So anyway, that was the Thunderbird. And that really was the pivotal point of a lot of things, because it tied in with the Peterson kind of expounding this philosophy of the company and the integrity of products, and, you know, the whole thing kind of come full circle then with having this kind of a vehicle and having a bit of a different approach to why you build cars and how you build them and all this. So
you obviously had turned a real corner there in terms of
no question. And you couldn't do one without the other. I mean, people wouldn't have accepted it without the kind of change in philosophy, and we couldn't have sold them a traditional kind of car if they were already heading the other way. So it was quite often things, I guess, fall together like that at a certain time. But
fortuitous.
And probably a lot of the reason, just because people having similar experience in the top jobs start to think, in a certain manner and approach a car a similar way. But it was exciting for us because we had kind of set aside the traditional nostalgia approach, even though we still have the town car out there for a certain kind of market, but we were able to really offer up something very special, we thought, for the luxury, more of a coupe approach.
Yes.
So then we did the Cougar, and we tried then, of course, to make as strong appearance difference from the side view and the silhouette to get the strong difference there.
Remember any of the discussions that went on about that particular device?
Oh, yeah. Lots of people felt, you know, we had them mixed up. You know, the Thunderbird ought to be the formal backlight. They always have that. And the Cougar ought to be the fastback because that's a European car. And, you know, there's endless discussions. But it really came down that they felt the formal backlight fit into a Lincoln Mercury sales situation better than reversing.
Right.
And it's proved out fine. You know, the Cougar's been a tremendous success. Lincoln Mercury's never sold as many. They've really done well. And the Thunderbird's been a tremendous success as well. And it seems to continue, which is, to me, very satisfying, because I don't feel like it was a overnight, great one day and then forget it next year. You know, it seems to have enough integrity that people still like it, a year later. And so that, we feel very proud of those vehicles and kind of what they represent in terms of redirection of the company in some respects. The Mark.
The Mark 7 was really your proudest.
Yeah, now the Mark 7 came then, of course, almost a year after, but we started on that in the fall of 80. And so really, again, I was working on Thunderbird and Cougar, busy, even though I hadn't planned to do all that. That became my project because our approach, Jack Telnick's approach, very much is to whoever does a design, the theme and all, it follows through. And that didn't necessarily used to happen. I mean, you could sell a car and then somebody else had to follow it. Well, that never works too well because you don't get the commitment and, it isn't your baby. So.
Did Telnick pioneer that approach at Ford?
Well, I think it, yeah, no, yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe for several reasons, but certainly that's his approach, and, it makes, we think, a little better chance of getting the product on the road right. So anyway, I'm busy with that, and so another group, a pre-program luxury car group who had been working on the Thunderbird Cougar, who don't have anything to work on now, so they start working on Marks. And so that's, you know, the summer goes through, and by fall, again, then during the winter, they're not winning. They've got all the formal roofs, they've got all the things that marketing and planning everybody can think of that ought to be the right way to go, but it isn't happening. And at that time, I think Lou Ross was the executive VP of product development. And anyway, it wasn't what they wanted. And so Bob Zokas was the director now by this time, and Jim Arnold was the exec. So we're given the task, well, all right, you guys try one. And so we only had one shot, where they had about three models going in the other room, I think. Maybe it's two. But anyway, very short fuse sort of thing. All right, we'll give it a shot. And so Gary Haas, my assistant, came up with a sketch and a full-size rendering. And one thing I want to get back to on that Thunderbird, on the rendering, we can get back to it. I just thought of an interesting thing on a rendering situation. But so anyway, we have a design that was chosen, and Jack liked what we did on the Mark, and we went ahead with a clay model. And after a couple of reviews, internal reviews, got it the way we felt we wanted it. Lou Ross supported it, and we had a mold made and researched it. And it came out quite strong. But basically, Jack and Lou Ross just decided that was the one they wanted to sell, and they went in and sold it. I mean, it was...
And what was your platform on?
Again, it was the Fox platform. Now, the Mark and the Continental really share the wheelbase and the suspension and all that, so are basically the same. And the Thunderbird is 4 inches shorter. So even though they all started from Fairmont Zephyr, you know, through the years, well, things have evolved a bit here and there. But yeah, I was going to relate back to that Thunderbird. We did a rendering when we were going through the luxury 8X luxury car approach, and we took a silhouette of the then brand new 1980 Mark two-door, and then we put our new design inside that, and it's like the box, you know, with the shape inside it, you know, it's like the car, and this is the box it came in. And that was a fairly, here's, you know, Jack showing this to all the top people, and the car just hit the road, the 80 had, and here we are showing them this little shape inside what they've already just got out there on the road, you know. And but we showed that rendering, I'll bet we showed it 50 times, you know, and people always would come away, yeah, that's what we've got to do, you know, go the unit construction, get the smaller, lighter car and all this, you know. So it was a different climate. Oh, you read the survey, and the Mark 7 that we had designed was really approved then, and as I say, Jack and Lou Ross went in and sold it to top management, and from then, it was just a matter of following through and getting the kind of quality that people expect in the Mark. But it's probably the biggest change. Thunderbirds have always been exciting cars. Marks have been, but in a different way. And now we have a real, true, functional luxury car.